Hello and welcome to this episode of Move, Breathe, Live with me, Wibbs Coulson, or sometimes my wife, Jenny Wren. Just a quick note to say that throughout this episode, myself and my guests sometimes do get a little bit potty mouthed. There is the occasional profanity. So if you find that right now you need to listen through headphones, if you've got kids around or something else, then it might be an idea to do so or come back later to this episode. I hope you enjoy the episode and will let me know what you think. I look forward to seeing you on the other side. Today's podcast is brought to you by me. Today's advert, I'm going to put myself out there, and I'm hoping that maybe if you enjoy this and you enjoy the conversations I have, you might well enjoy coming and joining me, my beautiful wife, Spirit Wren, Jenny, on our online platform. We offer 11 weekly classes, which includes meditation, breath work for people with long COVID, what else? Just yoga and movement. So the movement is much more kind of body weight centric, trying to understand your body, somewhere between my anatomy and motion work, but put into a class and just working the hell out and making you feel like you've done some work. So it's 11 weekly classes for the price of just £15 a month. So it's pretty cheap. Not that you should ever look at it this way, but it works at about 48p a class or something. So all classes are live and they're all recorded. So if you can't make one live, you can always catch up after via the members only section on our website. So if you're interested, please do head to mandukyayoga.com, mandukya.com. Oh, hang on, mandukyayoga, mandukyayoga.com/b-. Just become a member. In fact, just ignore that. Just go to mandukyayoga.com, certain in the top bar, or come down as become a member. Come and join us. Like I say, we've got a lovely growing community of nearly 100 members. We practice, there's early morning classes, there's midday classes, there's evening classes, something for everyone. And both me and Jenny get to teach you. So hopefully it'll be something that you might be interested in. If so, come and join us over at mandukyayoga.com and we will see you all soon. Enjoy the episode and we'll see you on the other side. Hey guys, how are we all? Hope we are well. Thank you for coming back for another episode. Please do remember to share it around. If you're new, then why not subscribe, like, do all of that side of things. Make sure you're up to date. So every week when a new episode comes out, you are there, although we are fortnightly at the moment. But the way we're going, that might change. So keep an eye out all the same. This week, as I say at the introduction of the episode, slightly different kind of guest. Normally we're looking at people who are in the kind of movement, physical health, sort of breathing realm of things. But today I was super lucky to have a guest called Charlie Walker on, who introduces himself quite eloquently. Some of you may have heard of him. If you listen to Joe Rogan, he was on there, I don't know, couple of months back, 6 weeks back, and he's an explorer and a general all-round traveling kind of guy. And I listened to his episode and I thought it was absolutely fascinating and I wanted to talk to him myself. So hopefully you will enjoy this. Some of you, if you suffer from wanderlust, might get a little bit of that. But let me know what you think. Hope everyone is well. By all means, do feel free to let me know what you think of these episodes. Please do let me know if there's anyone you would like me to chat to, because I'm always looking for different ideas, different thoughts. So I've got a few really good guests lined up over the next few weeks. We have got, so who have we got? Let me have a look. We've got Scott Carney, who most of you know, if you know him at all, as the guy who kind of wrote the first Wim Hof book. He helped Wim Hof kind of become into the mainstream. Super cool guy. He's also written an amazing book just recently about, where was it? Pakistan, East and West Pakistan, Brilliant. Fascinating book. We've got Mike Fitch, who some of you might know if you've heard of Animal Flow. He's the inventor of Animal Flow. Really, really cool guy. Then we have Barefoot Ted. He'll be up after this one. And then we have Physiology First, who are a charity nonprofit in America doing amazing work with teens to help them deal with their psychological and physiological stresses and hopefully help them deal with life a bit better. So as I said, we've got some amazing guests coming up over the next few weeks, so hopefully you will enjoy it. Enjoy this episode. As I say, please do let me know what you think. Please do remember to like and subscribe. It is up on YouTube as well if you prefer to watch it, and if you prefer to share it like that, then do please share it like that. Have a great day, one and all, and I'll see you all very soon. Right, guys, welcome back to another episode of Move, Breathe, Live. Today, I'm well stoked to welcome a slightly different sort of guest. Normally, obviously, we're talking to people who are in the movement, breathing kind of sphere and that kind of thing. But today, probably talking to someone who's moved and breathed and lived a hell of a lot more of a life than any of us really have. Welcome, Charlie Walker.
Thanks very much. That was a very nice introduction.
You're welcome. So before we get started, like, I think the easiest thing to do is I could try to remember everything you've done, but perhaps you can just briefly introduce yourself as with a bit of a rundown of all of the crazy things that you've managed to do in your, I mean, how old are you now?
About to be 35.
You're about to be 35. Okay, you're a few years younger than me. So in your 34, nearly 35 years, all of the experiences you've had. So not all of them. Let's not go too crazy, too deep, too quickly, but an overview.
Sure. Well, I guess to precise as succinctly as possible, when I was in my early 20s, I set off on a bicycle and I spent 4.5 years pedaling 43,000 miles or 70,000 kilometers across Europe, Asia and Africa with the goal to get to the furthest point or cape in each of those continents. So Nordkap up at the top of Europe, Singapore down at the southeast of Asia, and then Cape Agulhas down at the bottom of Africa, the southernmost point just close to Cape Town. So that involved cycling across the Sahara a couple of times through Tibet in winter, which was cold Fresh. And lonely and challenging, through Iran twice, Afghanistan. I chose to hike from Beijing to Mongolia on that journey, which is about 1,000 miles, as I had cycled that a few years earlier. And then I bought a horse and tried to ride that for a couple of months across the sort of the central area of Mongolia on the steppe, the grasslands. Then when I was in DRC or the Congo, a friend and I spent a month paddling a dugout canoe or a pirogue, essentially a hollowed out tree trunk, down a river, a tributary of the Congo, which was probably the more dangerous and sort of fraught part of that long journey. Since that bicycle ride, I have spent 8 months traveling the length of the geographical border between Europe and Asia, or the perceived border, by ski through the Ural Mountains, kayak down the Ural River, and then cycle from Kazakhstan to Istanbul. So that was about 5,000 miles, a little bit more. I've hiked and rafted across Papua New Guinea. I've climbed an unclimbed mountain in Kyrgyzstan. And earlier this year, I spent 2 months hiking about 600 miles through Arctic Siberian winter, temperatures down to the deep minus 40s, hiking along frozen rivers and then the frozen Arctic Ocean along the sort of on the ocean along the coast. And unfortunately, at the end of that journey, I was arrested stuck in a prison for about a month because Russia changed quite a lot in the course of my time there. That brings us up to now.
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone probably listening is probably realizing that they've probably not done a huge amount in relation to a lot of that. And I mean, it's almost a bit like, you know, where on earth did you start kind of diving into all of that? I guess to begin with, we'll start with your bike journey, because I've just read your two books. Well, I've audio booked them in all fairness, which you also read, which does help. But you kind of start off as what seems like a rather like innocent, naive young man. And the thing I love about how it starts is I kind of feel it's how I would almost start, i.e. you kind of almost drunkenly said, yeah, I'm going to go and cycle all of this. And then you just stuck to it.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of began, I suppose with hindsight, I'm a little embarrassed about this, but it sort of began with essentially a Homeric post. You know, I kind of got drunk in a wood in Siberia, sitting around a campfire, and said, oh, I'm going to cycle right. I just done my first short bike tour. I'm going to cycle right the way across, you know, like round the world or whatever. I sort of, you know, I didn't yet know exactly what the sort of route or concept would be, but I just knew that I wanted to go away on a bike for a very long period of time over a very big distance. And I am quite stubborn. So I ended up going through with it. And there are a lot of times when I thought, well, you know, this is absurd. But that's also somewhat a flippant answer, because I have been for several years by that point, I suppose, slowly building up to the idea of doing something large. You know, I'd read a lot of books by different explorers and I'd always wanted to emulate the idea of a grand journey, you know, the sort of the, you know, an odyssey, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I've kind of, in my head, I've kind of been starting to do something similar. And, you know, I feel like, well, these things are always easier, I feel, when you're younger, because freedom in your 20s and stuff is much easier than having houses and wives and dogs and stuff like that. But yeah, I guess when you started all of that, and you've obviously taken this like, yeah, sorry, I'm going to go and fucking tour the world on my bike. Even with your little sort of bits of touring and bits of exploring that you've done, could you have even remotely fathomed, I guess, some of the lows that maybe you might come across? Because as you say, you, well, through Tibet, you kind of managed to, we'll come on to in a bit, but you kind of nearly managed to kill yourself in a snowdrift, essentially. And then being attacked with stones in, I want to say Somalia, but yeah, I might be wrong. Yeah, okay, yes, Ethiopia, that's right. You know, all of these bits and pieces where kind of, and one of the things I really want to go into a little bit is the idea of like loneliness, I guess, and being alone and finding times when it's probably amazing and it's probably peaceful and, you know, under the stars. But after 4 years, before 4 years, is that even remotely possible to think of how low you can go at those times? But at the same time, is it even possible after 4 years to really enjoy those moments, I guess? Like maybe in the first few weeks and stuff, when you find a really peaceful spot, you might be like, oh, this is amazing.
It's a really good question. And I suppose, honestly, before I started this journey, I kind of had considered and knew that there would be plenty of low points, you know, there would be difficult times, but I think I still viewed those through the kind of lens of excitement and romanticism. I knew that I'd be more exhausted than I'd ever been before, be more alone than I'd ever been before, and that I would, you know, get ill in interesting places and get, you know, attacked in scary places, and you know, that all kind of just lent itself, I suppose, to the excitement of the journey when it was abstract. But once it was real, of course, it's a very different thing. And loneliness was the big one that, like, over the course of years, I slowly learned how to deal with. And there's no hack, there's no short kind of, you know, solution to that. It really comes from making sure that you want to be doing what you're doing and remembering that you want to do it. And I suppose also I felt less lonely when it was, so I wasn't cycling especially fast, to put in context. People who go off and cycle, I mean, the fastest round the world trip, for instance, Mark Beaumont a few years back, I think he was averaging something like 280 miles a day. I was, over the course of the whole trip, including days off and everything, I was averaging something like 30 miles a day, you know, right. Really not very much. I was taking my time. And that was, you know, very much the goal was the bike was a means to an end. I wasn't racing.
Yeah, yeah.
But when I was going quite slowly, that's when I was more liable to feel lonely when going quite slowly. When I had a sort of a mission, I've got a visa deadline and I'm chasing. Mm-hmm. Then I didn't, because you'd cycle all day and at the end of the day you'd pass out in your tent. You're just so relieved to not be sitting on a saddle. You know, presumably on a crop of saddle sores by that point.
Yeah.
That you feel kind of fine. And again, you know, it's sort of, I suppose this is almost a bit hackneyed now, but it's definitely in the more populous places that I felt more lonely. When I was in mountains and deserts and you know, tens or even hundreds of miles from anyone else, then I don't think I particularly did struggle with loneliness so much at those times.
Do you think that's something, I mean, I don't know, it's kind of hard, isn't it? But do you think that's something about when you are tens of miles from, or hundreds of miles from anywhere, from anyone and anywhere, but you're kind of in, you're in that nature, I guess, and you kind of maybe feel how small you are compared to like just the world, then actually it's kind of, you kind of puts you in your place and you're a bit like, you can find yourself within it a bit more.
Exactly that. There's I guess not to sound too wanky, but there's a sort of majesty to solitude in wild places. You know, there's a sort of, yeah, it's quite sublime being in the mountains mm-hmm. by yourself and being able to shout and hear your voice echo off, you know, valley after valley after valley, stretching dozens of miles, and knowing that no one's hearing it except you and a bunch of marmots. But if you're lonely in a place where there are lots of people and you don't feel particularly able to communicate with anyone, or able to, you know, particularly in more affluent countries, you know, I was usually in more or less the developing world, for want of a better term, but you know, going through parts of Europe, for instance, just felt a little bit different because there are a bunch of people, but I suddenly felt more disconnected from them than I would have from people in an African village, for example, because I was on such a skinflint budget that I couldn't buy into the sort of society, if that makes sense. Really stop for a coffee because it would cost a day's budget, you know, things like that. It just build a distance.
And then with that as well, because, you know, one of the things that you really come across, apart from, I might say Ethiopia again, I can't quite remember, but it was just South Africa, sorry, I think. But you basically, especially when you were going through Africa, even through Mongolia, through all of everything out east, you know, you would get put up left, right and center. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, we touched on the being in Tibet and you nearly killing yourself, you know, or you didn't nearly kill yourself, the weather nearly killed you, but you know, you kind of got out of that and then you got put up by a little old man or little family in their hut. And throughout most of the world, I guess it's really when they've, I don't know, it's again, it's that cliche thing of those with the least tend to want to give the most. And then, you know, if you're in Europe or a more Western world, I guess people are probably just a bit more, they've got plenty, they don't need to give. Do you know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's this strange, it's really counterintuitive, but the more people have, and this is a pretty decent rule of thumb for across the world, and I think it's pan-societal.
Yeah.
The more people have, the more they want to protect it, which, you know, it's ironic. I mean, you could take that to extremes, and, you know, the people who earn hundreds of millions of dollars or pounds or euros every year tend to pay next to nothing in tax, whereas people who earn, you know, average national income in the UK is about £28,000 a year, pay all the tax because there's no means by which to not, and I don't think they rail against it. Whereas people who are earning unimaginable sums that there is simply no need or use for, will begrudge, you know, even minuscule percentages. So yeah, it's an unusual, it doesn't make sense, but it does seem to.
I traveled through India for 6 months, like 8 years ago, and I definitely found the same thing. I mean, I remember the first day I even arrived and walking down this beach, and this little old lady just started chatting to me in sort of her, you know, best English that she had type thing. And, you know, come back shy, come back shy. And, you know, I went back to her house. This was literally my first day arriving in India. And, you know, I always, my wife and I always laugh at this. For one, like, it was a bit of a shock when I got off the aeroplane, got picked up in the taxi. And as I pulled out, there was a man just taking a dump on the side of the road. That was an eye opener for a slightly different world. But then this lady just took me into a house, and it was literally like four walls, like tiny little roof, no lights, you know, just a couple of windows, a bed pushed up against the wall, and had like her husband and two kids in there. And, you know, they would just have tea, you know, like wanting me to have a cup of tea. And it was, yeah, a real, wow, it's a different experience.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I want to slightly temper what I just said, because people are extremely friendly and kind and welcoming, even in, you know, more wealthy countries. It's just that there's barriers that life and wealth and also, I suppose, societal culture, infrastructure builds around people's lives. You know, like right now, it's a hot evening, and I'm, you know, sitting up in the loft, sweating and silently drinking water every time you talk, whereas in most other countries, people in this sort of weather would be sat out on the street watching the world go by. And we do live, and this is partly because I'm, you know, on a computer, but this is also because, you know, we don't have a space out the front. You know, it's just a very different sort of approach to life. The more gated your sort of existence is, the less likely you are to just encounter or, you know, interact with other people, strangers.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so you decide to go off cycling. Now, did you put any preparation work in? Obviously, you've been doing, you know, you've gone and done your little cycle that you've done, that decides that you're going to do it. But, you know, any training, any thoughts, anything, just like, nah, sod it, just jump on. Because I know you also, your bike, old Jeff, was, what, 100 quid?
I think it's £112.
£112. So not exactly a performance bit of kit.
No. It was, to be fair, it was secondhand and new. I think it would have cost about £300. So, you know, a little bit better. But I mean, I didn't need a good bike for it. I didn't train at all. The first couple of days were the only days where I had a bit of a necessity to cover a sort of a certain distance, because I had to hit the sort of free ferry crossing that the ferry company had given me.
Right.
So I think the first day I ended up cycling about 95 miles on hilly roads in southern England. And that was having not cycled more than probably 30 miles in a day for over a year, or around a year. So no, I didn't train. The only thing I really did by way of preparation was saving money, raising a little bit further money with sponsorship from a company, making a little website, and that's kind of it. I didn't get a single visa before I left. I didn't plan the route. I just had the kind of the outline of where I wanted to get to, and the places in between I'd figure out as I went along. The planning really was just kind of raising.
Get on and do it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Nice. I mean, I quite like that idea. I think that's it's very one of the guy. I'm obviously the guy. I had a guy called Nick Butter. I don't know if you know if you've heard of Nick Butter, but
yeah,
first guy runner to run. Yeah, and I had him on, and his 192 marathons in 192 countries obviously was the total opposite and had to be planned to the, you know, as best as possible to the nth degree. But I love the idea that, like, essentially freedom, you know you want to go here and here, and actually what's going to be the best roads to take, we'll just go and see what happens. And, you know, it kind of also leaves you that possibility of finding kind of friendship, love, whatever else on the travels while you're at it too. Did you, throughout, in particular, the first book, so your first book kind of takes you from home to essentially
Beijing,
to the north, all the way to Singapore, and then it brings you,
Beijing.
Yeah, up to Beijing, that's right. Yeah. So in that, it kind of, maybe because it's more Western and that's a more traveled route, but you seem to have come across a lot more people and also kind of, I'm not saying love, let's say as such, but there was definitely elements of, you know, you met some women and at times there was kind of I don't know, like, yeah, there was, I guess, love, and there was kind of relationships built through that. Did, you know, in your head, in those situations, does that kind of drive a, obviously that's a personal relationship, whereas kind of in what you're doing, it's almost like a, it's like a personal to yourself, like, this is what I want to do. Was there ever like a tearing of your own kind of thought process? Or, oh, I don't really want to commit to being too friendly with people because I don't, you know, this is my thing that I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I was, particularly for the first sort of year or so, I was really blinkered. Even in the sort of day to day, I sort of had, I suppose, at the back of my mind, a sense of progress and head down. And I wanted to see and visit the places I was going to, but I think it was about a year in that I, in a greater sense, kind of slowed down that little bit more and opened my eyes that little bit more and felt able to kind of linger whimsically that little bit more, you know, as opposed to, and a lot of that was due to, you know, the fact that during the first year, well, the first 3 months I was in the EU, but after that, I was up against sort of visa constraints for much of the time.
So
heading through Turkey, I only had 1 month. Heading across Iran, I only had 1 month. Through India, the same. China, I only have 3 months to cover a huge distance. And then down through Southeast Asia, which is where I started to slow down a little bit, I still had these kind of visa constraints. Whereas in after that, I seem to find, and I don't know if it's by coincidence or if I've managed to sort of engineer things this way, but I found myself spending more time moving slowly across larger countries. And that probably helped. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. With one of the, just kind of sticking on, I guess, like one of the bits of advice you were given in Mongolia, just while it's in my brain, I want to bring it up, was especially as you were going through deserts and stuff, was to try to keep your mouth dry. Now, this is something which I kind of use with some of my clients when I'm teaching breathing for runners and the like. They give you a bit of advice to try to keep your mouth dry and also, I guess, keep you salivating, I guess.
Yeah. So just a small pebble, you know, ideally the size of a, you know, half the size of a 1p coin, something very small, like a, but ideally rounded, you know, so it's not sort of uncomfortable, but you put that in your mouth and just keep it in your mouth, keep it on your tongue.
It try means not to that swallow got, it.
Yeah. Well, you've got something in your mouth that you don't suck on it. It's not boiled sweet, but it does make you salivate a little bit, and that helps keep your throat, you know, moist. But more importantly, it helps you, or it helps remind you to keep your mouth shut, because our mouths are a sort of a, you know, a wet cavity, and there's loads of moisture to lose through evaporation. And if you're losing this moisture through evaporation, largely off your tongue, the tongue will then produce more moisture to keep itself wet. So you're just, it's a sort of a, you know, it's like a dripping tap. That's, you know, you can lose a lot that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from the work I do with athletes and stuff is partly trying to get them to nose breathe more, shut their mouth more. And because it's about 42%, you lose about 42% more moisture through mouth breathing than compared to nose breathing. So
didn't know the number. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a big amount. And that's one of the reasons why when you see endurance athletes who nose breathe, they have to take on much less water than those who end up mouth breathing. So
Well, just as an indication of, you know, the moisture coming out of your mouth. I didn't even mention the fact that you exhale moisture. Whenever you see pictures of people in polar regions with a big beard of ice, that's all their breath that's frozen. That's moisture in their breath that's frozen. That's not ice that's sort of come to them.
Yeah, yeah.
That's come out of them.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I definitely want to come on to some of the polar bits in a minute, but one of the things that really, I mean, there's a whole bunch. One of the things I discussed with Nick when he did his run, or his like round the world run, and then I kind of feel like maybe the two of you, not maybe you got different, I don't know, around religion, I guess. So Nick kind of found when he did his run, like he found a real like positive feel to religion in the world, like as in, but I guess it was on a very personal level. Now, I'm not saying you didn't as such, but I think listening to your book, you definitely felt the how much maybe religion has kind of drawn or has torn certain areas of the world and fights and stuff.
Yeah, well, I suppose I left on that particular journey as a sort of relatively indifferent atheist.
Yeah.
And I came back a sort of confirmed and slightly more vociferous atheist. Yeah. I'm not someone who will corner someone in a pub and start yelling, "There is no God. It's all a lie." That's not really my thing. And I believe it's important that everyone is free to believe and practice what they want. That said, many, many religions, in fact, pretty much every religion, is filled with very, very unpleasant, not entirely, but is peppered, let's say, with a lot of quite unpleasant doctrine and ideas about the place of the role of genders or many, many other different things. But I do think that the more that people are taught and free to learn, the less religion plays a role. You know, there's a correlation between the better educated countries. It's not an exact correlation, but it is a correlation between countries with better education systems and rates of belief. You know, people look to Finland and New Zealand, for example, as the places where people are best educated, and also, you know, Denmark and Finland, happy places. And these are places that increasingly religion doesn't have a role at
much
all.
A role.
And it's something that's difficult to talk about because, for one, to take Christianity, people who are, you know, full-on Christians, hardcore Christians, or just believe all of the, you know, revelations, for example, they genuinely believe that everyone who doesn't believe what they believe is going to burn for eternity in a fiery pit, which is an awful thing to think.
And
that must be on a daily basis, that must be depressing or upsetting or even deeply traumatic to think that all these people that you know and like, who you know are good people but just believe the wrong thing or don't believe anything, are destined for, I mean, eternity is a literally unimaginably long amount of time.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that I suppose initially might have put me off religion. It's just, you know, a lot of people get to about 90 and think, you know what, I've had enough.
That's enough,
Exactly, I'll check out here, have a good long sleep. And so, it must be really hard to not sort of, you know, missionize essentially because of that profound belief. And so I hold nothing against, you know, anyone for their beliefs. It's just I suppose do quietly and sometimes less quietly hope that, you know, the trends towards irreligiosity, I suppose, continues, but not in a sort of not in a jarring way. So you look what Russia did for 70 years and now you look at the incredible resurrection of Russian Orthodox faith, because you can't suppress something, you have to teach. Which ironically is the central thesis of many religions. So it's a really tricky topic.
Definitely.
But I've seen many ways in which it's incredibly beneficial in people's lives as well, but I believe those benefits can be got through other means.
Found another method. Absolutely. There's bits in your book I found almost quite difficult to listen to, kind of just because of, you know, especially going through the Middle East, going through some of the stands and stuff like that. And, you know, I've made a few little notes of like in Iran of just, you know, 9-year-olds potentially being able to marry and, you know, that because of their readings of the Quran and whatever else were. And there was just a few bits in that when I was kind of listening and just being like, oh. Do you know what I mean? You can't even get your head around, you can't really get your head around that here.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember the exact numbers now. I think it was.
It was 9 and 12 or something, wasn't it?
I think it was 9 and 12 for girls and boys, respectively, after the Islamic Revolution. And then I believe it was put up.
13 or 15?
After Khomeini died. Exactly. That's right. Yeah. So it's not quite 9 anymore, but, you know, it has been. And,
yeah.
You know, there are still parts of the world where there was a very excellent, about 2 years ago, documentary by the BBC, where they went undercover with cameras and managed to find imams selling, essentially prostituting girls that were in single figures or very, very young, you know, 11, 12, 13, with temporary marriages, which is how prostitution is spun in some Islamic countries, whereby you're married with an imam, he marries you officially, and an hour later the marriage is annulled. Probably not annulled, because I suppose it is consummated, but then divorced. And, yeah. This is rape and trafficking, and it happens today.
Yeah. I think that's one. I mean, you in towards the end of your second book, you discuss, you kind of go into, I'm going to have to look it up now. Slavery and the like in
Mauritania.
Mauritania. That's it. Saying it was made illegal in the 80s or 90s. Or no, it was
80, it, I think.
Yeah, and then actually, it wasn't until 2007 or something that it was really.
There's still thought to be, I think, over 100,000 slaves in Mauritania today.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, throughout your travels, I mean, does we're seeing this, hearing this, reading this, all your travels that you've done, do you kind of get a feeling of hope, I guess, that perhaps those things are improving? Or is it almost, I kind of feel like at the moment there's, especially with left and right, kind of swinging left and right further and further and further, it's almost as if some of those, I guess you look at Iran from the 70s after the Islamic Revolution and whatever else, there's almost like this bigger swing back towards conservatism, back towards like that side of things. In your travels, seeing the people on the ground, I know there were some countries where there wasn't. And again, you might find this, I guess it's really difficult, you know, your recent travels to Serbia and Russia and the like. I feel all of these things end up having to change from the ground up, because you know someone like Putin's never going to say no thanks, I'm going to disappear now. But some of those countries where you talk, they literally, that's them. Do you know what I mean? Like it's the, whether it's propaganda or whatever else, that's what they believe.
Yeah, I feel. Firstly, I don't think there's any reason why any country can't change in any way for good mm-hmm. or bad. There's nothing innate in no. any part of the world or any people or genetic sequence or anything like that beyond appearance. And I suppose, the tendency to be able to, you know, some people in some parts of the world are better at long distance running, for example, due to, you know, genetic makeup. But yeah. to do with like culture, I used to be more hopeful, more optimistic about the general direction of travel. It felt I'm in my mid-30s, and I feel like I and my generation and you as well, I suppose, grew up at an almost unprecedentedly peaceful time in history. And of course that doesn't mean that there wasn't anything happening. There were plenty of wars, you know, in Europe, in Africa, you know, in Kashmir. There were wars, you know, all over the place, Chechnya.
Yeah.
Broadly speaking, the trend was of growing and spreading and improving democracy and human rights. And I feel like in the last, I mean, it's tempting to say 6 years since Trump got in, but I think the rot had set in a little earlier. The last, you know, 8 to 10 years, I feel like that has ground to a halt, and now has slowly started to reverse. And it's, I mean, America has just, they've just overturned Roe v. Wade, which is astounding. I presume you might have some American listeners, and people might dislike what I'm about to say, but America has just forfeited the right to lecture any other country on women's rights, because reproductive rights are absolutely central to women's rights, and privileging the life and well-being of an unborn fetus, sometimes just, you know, 4, 5, 6 weeks old, over the life of a mother who might have been raped, who might be underage, who might, many different things, who might have a child with a birth defect that's already been detected at an early stage, is you know, is flies in the face of women's rights. There are so many, I mean, there was this depressing point about a year ago, I think it might have been, I might be wrong here, it might have been with the coup in Myanmar, that the world tipped from having majority democracies, whether functioning or flawed, to a minority of democracies, whether functioning or flawed. So it's very easy, I suppose, to say, well, you know, how do we know democracy is the right system? But surely it goes without saying that the right system is the system that everyone agrees on. And the only way you can find that out is democracy. And if you want to vote in, you know, a monster, then I suppose you're welcome to. But if that monster then starts removing people's freedoms, it's no longer a democracy. And if that monster can no longer be voted out, it's no longer a democracy.
Yeah.
And so I actually feel thoroughly depressed by the kind of state of humanity at a governmental level around the world.
Yeah.
And with the sort of successive removal, failure of democracies or collapse of democracies, goes the collapse of human rights, because a country that doesn't privilege everyone or value everyone equally will inevitably value some people over others. And normally, sadly, that tends to be old people over young people, or men over women, or people of one faith over another, or people of one tribal identity over another, or people of one political identity over another. And, you know, the US isn't immune from this, Britain certainly isn't immune from this, and that's all, you know, come to an incredible crescendo at the moment. And now we're going to watch it sort of play out again with this crazy succession battle that is appealing to a tiny and relatively homogenous, you know, portion of society, while the rest of us just kind of stare, mouths agape. So yeah, sorry, long and ranty answer to your question, but I don't feel particularly hopeful, sadly. And travel makes me feel hopeful in many ways, and, you know, people make me feel hopeful, but politics currently doesn't.
Oh, it's hideous. I mean, you know, going to, let's jump ahead again, sort of just up to your most recent thing then, just for, on, I guess on that, with, let's stick with some depressing depressing subject. Obviously, you, as you said, you've just ended up in, not just, but you ended up in jail earlier this year, because you were hiking, you were, well, maybe you can explain it better, but you basically were hiking across the Siberian Northlands, I think, and yeah, you managed to set off 3 days before Russia invaded Ukraine.
Yeah, well, I flew into Russia. I arrived 3 days before the invasion. Right. I was still in the regional capital, Yakutsk, when the invasion took place. And I had to make a bit of a judgment call. Do I stick with this journey that I've spent, you know, quite a while I mean, this is a little different from my bike ride, going in temperatures, extreme cold temperatures. You do have to prepare, you have to gather the right kit. I needed funds, and you know, I spent a while putting it all together, and I had to ask, do I want to sort of throw all this away because of what's happened, you know? And me leaving, you know, wouldn't have made a statement, really. So it was really, do I feel personally safe to carry on? Mm-hmm. And at the time I did, and with hindsight, perhaps I was wrong, but also there's a chance that had things gone very slightly differently towards the end, I might not have ended up in prison had I managed to get a flight one day earlier out of my end destination, then things might have been different. But I was also so far away, just geographically, so far away from Moscow or Kyiv, that it felt like somehow that distance made things less severe where I was. And I think with hindsight, to some extent it did, but definitely not to the extent that I'd expected.
Do you think your experience of everything when you were traveling, i.e. is almost comical in some ways, the amount of times that the Africans would say to you, like, no, don't go that way, lions, they'll eat you, lions. And then, you know, you were just like, oh, everyone says that, I'm just going to go and sleep in a tent there. Do you, has your experience of, you know, everyone saying, don't do that, it's bloody stupid, you'll be, you know, that you're definitely going to die, and then actually you just went and did it anyway, and, you know, your ability to kind of go, where you're kind of, I think you said your fatalism of like, well, if it happens, it happens, I bonk, fall asleep. Was there, to a certain degree, some element of being in, you know, Siberian, being a bit like, he's probably not going to do it anyway. Yeah, I know he's amassing his troops there, but he's probably not actually going to, like, you know what I mean? It's probably just a show of power and just, you know, power play.
Yeah, well, I think everyone thought that. And my, I suppose my relationship with risk, as is everyone's, is constantly evolving. And hopefully developing, you know, growing. But at the same time, like you say, you do, it does become almost habitual to dismiss warnings from people who might be less informed. You know, if you're talking to a to take the example of African wildlife, for example, if you're talking to a game warden at the gates of a national park and he says, well, we've got about 400 elephant and they tend to hang out in this area here, so you might want to avoid that, then you might want to avoid that.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're talking to just someone in a village who, with the, you know, the best, you know, intentions in the world, says don't go and camp in the bush because, you know, the bush is a dangerous place and we like to live in houses because it's safe. Yeah. And if you sleep in the bush, then something bad could or might happen. Then that's when you can take it with a pinch of salt. But in Russia, I didn't. No Russian people, for instance, told me, you know, you should go home straight away. I think I'm not certainly at the beginning. I didn't have any messages from home saying you should come home straight away.
As you say, you were so far away. Really, when you look at a map where you were compared to, as you say, kind of Russia into Ukraine, you'd almost kind of feel like that's bad, probably a bad analogy, but it's almost being like, oh, well, I'm going to cross from, like, I don't know, France into Germany. And that's, you know, there's almost like there's something going on down in Croatia.
I was six time zones away from Moscow. So that's the same as, for example, Paris and New York in time zone difference. Although obviously I was in the same country, the same political entity, I was just really, really distant. You know, I was on the same time zone as Pyongyang, you know, really far out there, actually even 1 hour ahead of Pyongyang, I think. So it was, it was just a case of thinking, well, I'm just going to keep my head down and get on with this and sort of see what happens.
And so did it surprise you the you know, because you talk about, I think it was on Joe Rogan you were talking about it, but like, it probably was, but, you know, how people started, like, essentially phoning ahead, telling people where you were, and you know, and almost like the crazy West and the guys in our country, like, and almost that small-mindedness might be the wrong word, but that kind of fear, suspicious. That kind of suspicious nature.
Suspicion, yeah.
Like, well, did that surprise you, being that far and being almost in the middle of nowhere as well?
I've traveled in remote parts of Russia before, and I've actually twice before this journey been through the Russian court system, so I've got some familiarity with the authorities there. It didn't surprise, once I, you know, as I got in drips and, you know, I was sort of, I guess, drip fed occasionally bits of news from outside. I wasn't really getting phone signal. Occasionally I was able to call my girlfriend and you know, via just on a phone, you know, without, I didn't have 3G very often. I had very little contact with the outside world. But as the little bits of news came in about, you know, from the outside, because news in Russia was of course very different. Mm. As the news came in from the outside about what was happening in Ukraine, and particularly when, you know, the mass atrocities in Bucha and other sort of, you know, Kyiv satellite towns came out. And from the very start, the Russian state was quickly shutting down opposition voices. They, you know, they closed down the last independent TV station within days of the invasion. They brought in a new law about 10 days after the invasion, implementing a sentence of up to 15 years for anyone deemed to be spreading fake news about the military or the special operation, as they called the invasion or the war. And that was basically just a way of silencing journalists. And, you know, you bring in a law like that and you don't really have to do anything else, because people realize, oh, if I say anything, then, you know, all dissent was pretty much immediately silenced. The first wave of protests that broke out across the country ended with about, I think, eventually 15,000 arrests. And after that, there was basically not a peep.
I mean, it's amazing that so many people, even like when they first did bring that out, the amount of people who still seem to complain at that first bit, and then they all just seem to vanish. And then it's kind of like, I mean, that's where I think, as a saying, and where you've probably said you're not that hopeful, you kind of think there was a lot of people who protested and like who tried to say something. And then you kind of go, well, Putin didn't really seem to give a shit.
Yeah, I think it was... There was a sense at the very beginning where for maybe 2 days where it seemed like maybe there'll be a popular uprising. Because you know, the only way to get rid of Putin, short of someone more or less on the inside within his cabal, you know, topping him, the only way really is for a mass popular uprising. And, you know, on a smaller scale, Belarus tried that a few years ago, and it just turned out that his grip on the, you know, the sort of police state, the security state that Lukashenko had built up, was enough to quash the huge opposition. But invading Ukraine, a country that many Russians see, or at least saw, as a, you know, almost a sibling state, you know, you know, the Ukrainian people are their kin, their brethren. Yeah. That belief for many has changed through just months and months of insane propaganda about fascism.
But for a couple of days, it seemed like
Russia might rise up and do something, but there just weren't enough people who believed what was happening was wrong or felt that there was anything they could do about it. And so, you know, quickly the kind of rot set in. And from that point onwards, it actually didn't surprise me that the country became more and more suspicious. It just quickly hurtled back to the sort of sense of paranoia, you know, even in small settlements that have nothing to do with all this, just paranoia that must have been there for you know, 7-8 decades throughout, you know, from the Bolshevik Revolution onwards. Exactly. And that's a culture of people informing on each other, or in this case, informing on me. And you know, everyone's watching everyone again, and you know, it was fascinating and deeply disturbing to watch that, you know, sort of, you know, backslide.
And you were just hiking, were you, doing this?
Yeah, just hiking.
Seemed like you were suspicious, like just hiking through the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, well, so where I finished and where I was arrested, they said I'd been conducting illicit journalism, for starters, photographing military sites and asking provocative questions about Ukraine. And it turns out where I finished, this port town on the Arctic coast called Tiksi. Tiksi used to be a restricted or a closed area due to kind of security, because the whole coast is a border zone.
Yeah.
And then in January last year, they declassified it.
Right.
And that's what facilitated my journey. And I thought, great, well, it's, you know, I'm allowed to go now, I'll do it. And in the past, you could go, but it involved a sort of lengthy permit application process. So, you know, I could have gone before. Now it felt that much more doable and sort of, you know, legit above
board. Yeah.
But they, in about 2018, they started installing, I didn't know this before I went, but they started installing surface-to-air missiles. And it turns out that Tiksi, or just outside Tiksi, this kind of military installation is a sort of hub of their Arctic defense strategy. So Russia is paranoid about, you know, any other nation with a aircraft carrier during summer when the ice is open, or even with an icebreaker during winter, just kind of coming in from the north. Which is mad, of course, because if you're gonna if you're gonna try and attack Russia from the north, you probably just send some missiles. You're not, you know, it's
not gonna send faff, you know, it's exactly. A lot of faff and money.
Yeah, it's a really hard place to get to, and supplying a war up there for anyone that isn't Russia would be basically impossible.
Yeah,
you know, just to you know, maintain a war effort. Anyway, I was close to that. Installation, and although they never, you know, I hadn't been photographing it, I didn't know it was there. They provided no evidence that I had been, but
they don't need to. The
evidence doesn't matter.
No. So when you're in that situation, then, so for me, one of the things I find most interesting about your whole story, from everything, from like just jumping on a bike and fucking off, and like working it out as you go, to you know, taking a boat down a bloody the Democratic Republic of Congo when they're saying, don't do that. It's the worst bit of river you can possibly do. To you ending up, say, in prison, it's like the mental place that you must end up being at times. And throughout that time when you've been arrested, you're in prison, and like your head must go, you know, at first you must just think, oh, it'll be all right. This will just pass quite quickly. But after a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, like, again, with everything and however bad your brain, your head must have been on some of your travels, being in, you know, a Russian jail, and, you know, we know how bad this current government is at dealing with people. You know, you look at Boris Johnson's balls up of Nazanin Zaghari's thing in Iran. But like, as the time ticks on, how do you keep your head in a space of, we'll be all right, we'll get out of this, this will be fine? Can you?
There are definitely times when I didn't. I think to start off with, I had, I suppose, just a kind of an innate faith that it'll be all right in the end. It's partly due to the nature of how they imprisoned me. They didn't give me very much information, and I was given the impression that I'd just be there for a few days. But as the days wore on, and as I then subsequently, 2 weeks in, I had I'd hired a lawyer by this point, and I had a court appeal hearing that was immediately rejected. It was after that I thought I could be here for a really long time. Mm. And at the back of my mind, I was aware of this potential 15-year sentence, and everything they'd accused me was you know, a perfect sort of, you know, case against me under that new law.
Yeah.
So there are definitely times where I felt true despair, in a way that I, in a sort of long, you know, for a protracted period of time that I haven't experienced before. And honestly, and you know, I should qualify, I was there for a month, you know.
Mm.
It's plenty long enough, but it's also not a long time.
It's not 15 years, it's whatever.
Not 15 years, it's not 6 years with Zaghari Ratcliffe. Yeah. I believe Brittany Griner has now been in prison for 4.5 months, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
More. Yeah, maybe coming up to 5 months. And, you know, that for me, I suppose the way to cope with it was to, I'm not sure in the relatively short amount of time I had there that I fully did confront it. Because at no point was I told, right, you've got
15 years
or 10 years or whatever. And if I did, then it would be a case of coming to terms with that. But for me, I was sort of on a daily basis coming to terms with uncertainty.
But is that not even worse, do you think, sometimes?
Well, so within the time frame that I had, if I'd been told at the beginning, you've got 1 month and then we're sending you home, then I should think within about 3 days, although there would have been bad times ahead, I'm sure, but within about 3 days, I reckon I probably would have, you know, made my peace with what that was and just got busy with keeping busy and waiting. Or get busy dying.
get busy
living or get busy dying.
That's it. A bit of Shawshank.
Yeah. But because I wasn't sure, and not every day, but many days, I'd wake up thinking, well, maybe they'll let me go today, or maybe they won't, or maybe it'll be many days or weeks or whatever. That was difficult. And I suppose distraction was, given that I didn't know how long it would be, trying not to think about it, which isn't confronting the problem, which is a slightly different thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Was how I went about it. So I kept myself as occupied as I could with, you know, walking laps up and down my cell, or doing, you know, exercises, or doing, you know, I did a lot of Rubik's Cube, and I read a lot, and I wrote a lot, although I was always a bit sort of surreptitious with my writing, hiding anything I wrote amongst other legal papers. So yeah, it was largely distraction, and I suppose trying to, while I was able to, ignore, you know, the problem, which is maybe not the best way to go about it.
I guess sometimes you just don't really have a choice, though, do you? I guess, you know, if you are in such uncertainty, like, I don't know, I guess ignore it for as long as possible and hope it resolves itself. And if it doesn't, then figure out another way around it.
Yeah, I think it was just a case of coping until I knew more. And it the way things happened, it turned out that the time I knew more meant that it was pretty much the end. You know, it was only about 2 days after I found out I was going home that I went home.
Yeah. Nice.
I think in many, many ways I got incredibly lucky, despite the fact that, you know, I was banged up in prison. I was very, very lucky.
And did you, so, you know, in the first book, at one point you're kind of learning some Russian. Did having some Russian in any way aid you? I don't know if when you came back from post travels before going out to Russia, and obviously your triathlon, you know, down the length of the world, essentially, probably brought you much more into that world of things again. Like, you know, are you relatively fluent in Russian to a degree that you could, it helped you in any way? Or, you know, was having at least just the pidgin Russian that maybe you had, did that at least give you some kind of, ability to converse? I think in my head, a bit like what you said earlier, having no ability to converse with someone, especially in that kind of stressful situation, probably make things worse.
Well, I'm certainly not fluent in Russian. I am, I suppose, sort of...
conversational?
A long-term beginner, if that makes sense. You know, I've got basic conversational Russian, I guess.
Yeah.
In the past, whenever I've had sort of brushes with the authorities, I've just said I don't speak any Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And that will, firstly, it frustrates them because they've then got to go through a faff, you know, a process of trying to find someone to translate and whatever else. But the first brush I had with the police on this journey, so I came across the police after about 3 weeks, and then again about 4 weeks later, first brush I had with the police, they didn't speak a word of English, and we were in a Jeep on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere. And I was just being polite, so I spoke the best Russian I could, and we spent about an hour managing to converse, you know, with some difficulty, but we got there. But that then, I think, helped or enabled them to accuse me of journalism, which is what the first charge was that first time, as it subsequently was again later. Because it seems like I can talk with people and therefore I can conduct journalism. It helped me, you know, language itself helped me meet people and gave me some access to and insight into the lives of people I met. But it also, you know, became a problem, or at least my failure to hide that became a problem later on.
Yeah. One of the things I found, and it's probably listening to you on Rogan discussing all of this side of things, but also going through your book, is the bit when you were talking in your second book all about Afghanistan, Iran, all of Persia, all of the history of all of this stuff. Now, I find some of the history of like this stuff fascinating, and I have worked my way through a lot of Dan Carlin's hardcore histories about Genghis Khan and about the Persian monarchy and dynasty, if you like, of Cyrus, whatever his name is, however you pronounce his name, Did you have a fairly solid understanding of all, like, of those histories as you were going through those places, or is that stuff you've learned since coming back and the stuff you...
I didn't know before I first went to Iran. I knew very little about the kind of the history, and especially the ancient history of Iran. It was quite easy to start learning about the sort of modern history of Iran, the Islamic Revolution, etc. There are lots of people I met who had lived through it. The ancient history, I mean, I visited twice on my bike ride, or maybe three times even. I visited Persepolis, which was the sort of capital of Darius the Great, and then nearby Pasargad, which was the capital of Cyrus, or Kumash, Cyrus, as they say.
Yeah.
We say Cyrus, Cyrus the Great. When I was on that long bike ride, I read only paperback books. I didn't have a Kindle, which did mean at times, I believe once in Iran, I was carrying, I think, 10 books, which is not exactly the way many people choose to bike pack. But I found it hard to get hold of books about the places I was in. Sometimes I managed to. Nowadays, I you know, I do travel with a Kindle, so I'm able to have books about where I'm going to and be learning about those places while I'm there. But I mean, learning about places is just a continual process.
You're never done
with it. There's always more to learn. And once you think you've learned everything, then suddenly, you know, you've learned something else's perspective and the whole, you know, thing starts again. In the same way that, you know, I went to school in the 90s and the noughties, and I learned various things about British history, and now we're sort of reassessing and deciding that maybe rural Britannia and sort of, you know, naked jingoism isn't perhaps the best approach to history. And we're kind of reassessing, and I think one really neat way of summing up historical perspective is the fact that we talk about the Indian Mutiny of 1857, and Indians talk about the First Great War of Independence of 1857, when the, you know, the Indian people for the first time in a quite concerted effort, it had its atrocities on both sides, but they tried to throw off the colonial yoke. And after about 9 months of sort of, you know, of insurrection, as the Brits would call it, or freedom fighting, as the Indians would call it, the mutiny or the independence
revolution
was put down, the revolution, exactly. That example has always stayed with me. There are plenty of other equivalent examples of just the title of something being viewed very, very differently by different sides of an event.
There's always that thing of history is written by the people who win, isn't it? So it's kind of, you know, being able to look through the different lens. Cool. There's lots of little amazing stories, which, I mean, I'll just tell people to read your book or to listen to your book, because I mean, the thing that got me, one of the bits that got me was while you were in, I want to say Congo again, I can't remember, but anyway, you basically got malaria and then yellow fever, I think, as well.
Typhoid fever.
And then, you know, as a nurse, kind of freaked me out a little bit, kind of being, given quinine, given infusions just through a dirty needle, which, you know, the bloke's just blown the dust off and stuck it in you. Does that stuff, like in my head, when I heard you talk about that, was that to me, like, feels like it would be something which would stick with me afterwards? Like, I'd be, because I've previously, just as a nurse, you know, bear in mind, we use like clean needles, and, I've had a needle stick injury where I've been in like taking blood from someone and they've moved or whatever, and it's stuck me. And that kind of, for quite a while afterwards, even though you go and get your bloods done, you checked, in the back of your head, you're just like, oh my God, what if they've got HIV? What if they've got blah, blah, blah. Was that something which kind of stuck in your brain?
I think you'd be more prone to that because you're a nurse. The risks. And, you know, I was quite naive. Of course, I knew about the risks of, HIV and in various different parts of Africa. I knew of the greater or lesser prevalence. There's one city I remember visiting in Kenya, just on the edge of Lake Victoria, Kisumu, which has, I think, something like hopefully it's gone down, but it had something like a 48% prevalence for HIV, which is an astounding,
isn't it?
Very upsetting. But in Congo, firstly, I was so out of it with, you know, I was more or less delirious for the best part of a week. So I didn't really have any other choice. And once I got better, I had got better. Things like this are easier said than done. I think everyone has a different propensity for dwelling on the past or not. I don't particularly dwell on the past and try not to, which perhaps means that sometimes I don't learn the lessons from my mistakes that I could, and maybe other people are learning more lessons from my mistakes than I am. I do try my best to, you know, to take the important points away. But in the same way that several people have asked me since this Russian experience, did I regret it or not? Mm. Do I regret it or not? And I can't fully regret the whole thing. No. And it's sort of redundant to do so.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's no point agonizing over things that have happened. The only thing I actually do regret from what happened is the stress it caused for loved ones.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I mean, we've kind of waffled on for an hour already. So, I mean, like I say, I could probably ask you just individually about every single country you went to and, you know, whatever else. But, I mean, and you probably don't really want to go on about potentially things, you know, planning next. But do you have much planned for the for the future?
I've got a few ideas tucked up my sleeve and a bunch of sort of, you know, older ideas that have been floating around for a while. I don't yet know what will be next. But I suppose if people follow along on social media,
absolutely,
CW Explore, then that'll be the best place to find out first what's in the pipeline.
Perfect. One of the things I wanted to ask was did you, because I know on your triathlon, you put a map, there's a picture of the map of the road you took, essentially. Now I know completely, you probably don't know exactly every road you took on your bike ride, but have you done a bit of a map idea of like, we started from here and I kind of went down through here and I ended up, because listening, like I almost want, like what I've been doing for the last 2 days is like every time you got into a new country, I'd be like, right, go on Google Maps, and I'd be trying to see, okay, so you're coming out of there, coming down there. That was one of the things I just thought would be pretty interesting to see, just quite the scale of what you did.
That's the one downside to audiobooks, is they don't have the maps and pictures that you get in a published book.
In that case, I will...
hang on 1 second, I can show you some maps. There we go. Got the, you know, these...
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there we go. Look. There we go. That's upside down, but close.
There you go.
There we go. Perfect. Oh, in that case, I'll just have to get myself a real hardback or a proper copy as well. Nice. I've kind of said on a couple of podcasts now, partly in a bit like your Homeric kind of braggadocious way of doing things. Like I've kind of got a bit of an idea because I live barefoot. Like basically I just go everywhere barefoot, and I've got a bit of a thing. I want to run a bit like Nick Butter, he ran around the coast of the UK, and I want to do the same. I want to do it all barefoot, and I want to just kind of go and see all of the UK like that. So I'm kind of a bit like you. I'm kind of figuring if I just say it in public, then I'm going to actually have to pull my finger out in the next kind of like year or so and do it. But
given that people love going to the beach to get pissed, that's probably the highest density of broken glass you're going to find in the country that is on the edge of it.
But
I'm sure your feet are toughened up and you'll be fine. That sounds like a cool adventure.
Yeah, hopefully will be. So as always, obviously, as I say, you are a slightly different kind of guest, but kind of I do enjoy kind of chatting to someone like yourself, because again, from my perspective, I learned so much from your books about history in general, about people. Again, it is that thing of, I love hearing you talk about places like Afghanistan or Iran and stuff, especially on your first trip to Iran. I think, you know, just how lovely everyone was, how friendly, you know, even in these war-torn places that you're told are the most dangerous place in the world, there's always stories of like essentially love and friendship and like, you know, just giving. So, you know, if you're going to buy these books, then I would highly recommend it and get that out of it. But this podcast is called Move, Breathe, Live. And as I say, you've definitely moved. You've probably taken a fuck ton more breaths than most people have. And you've definitely lived more of a life than most of us have. So is there anything, you know, whether it be a philosophical thought process or action or just, you know, a physical thing that maybe you did or can suggest to someone to maybe move, breathe or live a happier, healthier life? Is there something that maybe they could take away from this podcast, apart from to buy your books, obviously?
it's a difficult question to avoid, because there's so much wisdom in this area, and inevitably a lot of the wisdom in that area various different people have arrived at, so it almost becomes hackneyed or cliched. And I'll try my best to avoid that, but I suppose where I can offer maybe some, you know, value is on the live side of things, because although I spend a lot of my time moving and going off on journeys, you know, everyone has different approaches to that, and you know, going for a good walk each day or every other day or whatever is just as valid as going off for a, you know, canoe down a river. But on the live side of things, I mean, the first cliche that springs to mind is, you know, you'll only regret the things that you don't do as opposed to the things that you do. And I think that's largely true. But I think the simple one I'm going to give is the world is a much, much, much more kind and nurturing place than we often allow ourselves to believe. And if we, you know, read stories about, you know, let's say some despotic or troubled or war-torn African country, those stories are largely relating to governance or failure of governance. And, you know, the same with America. You know, we hear horror stories about America and all the gun crime and stuff, but America is still, although the homicide rates are, you know, many, many times that of most European countries, for example, it's still a very safe place with very friendly people. And pretty much wherever I've been in the world, whenever I've got into trouble, and this is often more true of countries you would less expect it to be, people have just found me and helped me and looked after me. And people's default reaction is basically kindness and nurturing. And it's very easy to become cynical about the state of the world if you, you know, again, here's the cliche, if you just read the news and the papers. But actually, your average person wishes you nothing but goodness, even if they don't know who you are.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I mean, I think that's kind of, whenever I read any of these kind of, you know, travel, adventure, exploring type things, that's probably one of the main things I always take is, you know, just actually, you know, that thread of humanity is actually much stronger than I think. It's easy, and especially, as you say, when everything's as maybe as crazy as it is in the news, and also as, like, you know, as you say, if we're sitting watching Boris fight it out with Jeremy Hunt and whatever else or whatever, you know, you kind of, it's very easy to just see the good in people, because most of those people seem to not be that great. But yeah, the day-to-day people always just seem to come through pretty well. Well, thank you so much for giving me your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure to actually get to talk to you and to talk about some of your stories. And like I say, I've literally got a list. I kept making notes about different places. And but if anyone wants to find you, as you said, you're on Instagram and socials at CW Explore.
Correct.
Your website, cwexplore.com.
Com.
And yeah, you can see everything that Charlie's doing on all of that stuff there. So I'll put it all in the show notes so you guys can check it out. I can highly, highly recommend his books. He does read his audio books as well, so that's well worth listening, because now you've heard his voice, it'd be shit if somebody else read it. So yeah, thank you so much for this, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on.
No worries. Thanks, mate.